morning, everyone. So, John Graff made a good point to me during the break right before this that I sort of casually use you know public servants, public employee unions, government worker unions, all interchangeably, but not everybody actually really understands that when people talk about public employee unions or public unions, because the word public gets used for everything in this country and in the dialogue, you know, regardless of whether things are actually public. When we're talking about public employee unions, we're talking about government unions. So this is, you know, this is not Teamsters, this is not, you know, janitors, this is government workers unions. And so the first thing is, you know, there's this is obviously not probably the conception of folks in this room of what are public servants, but I think it's kind of the traditional concept of public servants. And so they're folks that, you know, take pretty crappy jobs because they want to make life better for everybody else. And I will say I have, you know, a fair number of friends and acquaintances that work for the government, and some are actually like that. Some actually are doing things that are relatively in the more relatively sensible end of the spectrum of things that government does. And they really are, you know, pretty much motivated by trying to, you know, make things work. And, but then, so it's not per se the workers, though there are plenty of government workers who are venal or cognitively constrained, as Julian put it. but you know, what's the problem really is the unions. And these are organizations that represent these workers whose mission is to oppose the taxpayers and get a better deal for their members. That's their job, is to negotiate against the taxpayers for a worse deal for taxpayers and a better deal for their members. Seems like that's not really in the public interest for such things to exist, and yet somehow these two things get conflated. But I want to break down that assertion in a much more direct way, this idea that government workers are there serving the public's interest. So, a few things. This is, I put this up first, this is almost my favorite, that federal workers far more likely to die on the job than get fired. There is, you know, this idea that unions are constantly trying to repudiate, that, oh, you can fire a government worker. Everybody knows you can. Well, maybe we can, but we certainly don't. Because if they're croaking faster than they're being fired for performance, you know, there's something going on there. And the, you know, the comparison there on the last bullet is in the private sector, you know, it's not a massive number. Anybody who's an employer knows you don't fire a whole lot of people. It's a relatively small percentage that just don't perform and have to be let go. 3%. That's still vastly more. Let's see. We've got a 0.18% in the federal government for at least the high paid. Notice also how much of the ones who actually do get laid off in the first 2 years. So it's not actually performance. It's bumping. It's when most of the time when the government lets people go, it's because of a budget crunch, and they let the most recent employees go first regardless of performance. So it's even worse than it looks in these outrageous statistics. Wages and benefits. You know, I'll point out that video. Two things about that video. Chris Reed, who has subsequently left the San Diego Union-Tribune and now full-time blogs just on California stupidity, essentially. so he has a lot of material. But he made the comment about the fact that the wage disparity argument is no longer true, that we don't have to give outrageous benefits to public workers because they're not grossly underpaid. And I'm going to break that down in several ways. The other thing I'll point out is that Carl DeMaio, the mayoral candidate there, is a fantastic guy. A, he used to work with Reason years ago before he went into politics. He's a gay Republican who's actually a libertarian. So he's got it. And he's, you know, he's a fiend. He actually writes this stuff. He writes like policy studies. I mean, how many politicians are actually that intellectually into, you know, budget and fiscal issues?
What's his chances of winning?
Pretty good, actually, yeah. You know, he's really championing a lot of policy change, even as he's running for office. Don't we wish Romney was actually trying to get some of the things done that he talks about while he's campaigning? You know, DeMaio is actually running ballot initiatives and trying to get things done while he's a council member and running for mayor. He's not waiting until he's mayor and just making promises. Anyway, back to the wages. So here's one way of slicing it. And this is, you know, Department of Labor statistics. And you can see pretty straightforwardly in a very aggregated way, no evidence that government is underpaid. Here's another, this is USA Today, lined up workers and divided them into categories of similar. So secretaries compared to secretaries, managers compared to managers, janitors compared to janitors kind of thing, and still found a huge pay premium for being in the federal government. Slicing it yet another way, or this is actually still the USA Today, but then they broke it down, you know, by pay brackets. And the most interesting is of course, the most highly paid workers. But the killer thing here is it between 2005 and 2010, okay, so you realize there's 2 years of non-recession there and 3 years of recession. And yet the number of really highly paid federal workers just skyrocketed. This is your stimulus dollars at work. Because most of the stimulus money went to federal agencies to hire more people. And they hired really highly paid people. We might be stuck with those people for the next 20 years too. And then this is the latest thing. Just a couple of weeks ago, CBO came out with a report that Congress requested, saying, okay, we want you to look at this by educational achievement. Because the response to the USA Today was, well, yeah, but the workers in the government are on average much more highly educated than workers in the private sector. And that's why even though they have the same job, they're getting paid more. So CBO said, well, okay, let's take a look at that. And what you can see is that it's something we at Reason have known for a long time due to our privatization work is that the government overpays less educated people and underpays highly educated people. So basically when you privatize, generally speaking, unskilled people lose out and skilled people benefit, at least as far as the workers who have to transfer from the government to the private sector. This is equally true for state government, by the way, in general. But, you know, To a slight extent, this is where you kind of have the real public servants in the sense of my first slide. These are people who actually take a hit in pay and benefits in order to work in the public sector. Unfortunately, these kind of people tend to be much more political appointees, senior bureaucrats, and people who are getting perhaps non-pecuniary benefits from being in those jobs, like they took this job for 3 or 4 years and then doubled their salary going back to the private sector with all that experience working at EPA or whatever, becoming a lobbyist. There's a lot of soon-to-be lobbyists in that column right there, I can tell you. Okay, so leaving aside salary comparisons, pensions, and I've talked several times at Reason Weekend about pensions. We track this pretty regularly, both in the policy division and on Reason Magazine. And I thought this was just interesting because this is just a timeline of studies. So, okay, Pew in 2008 says there's $1 trillion in unfunded liabilities for pension and health care. 2 years later, $2 trillion. Same year, different calculation. Mostly keep by doing a better job of incorporating state and local governments, $3.5 trillion. A even more detailed analysis done by these two university professors that took into account these numbers accepted rosy market return scenarios by a lot of pension funds. These guys actually broke that out and said, well, what if they actually earn something more reasonable in terms of their rate of returns? What do we get? And we get, so let's just say there's a trend here. There's a lot of unfunded liabilities, and they're probably a hell of a lot more than anybody realizes even at this point, because that's only state governments. If somebody did this style of analysis on state, local, and federal, we're probably pushing something god-awful like $8 to $10 trillion. So, it just makes me nauseous. now, one of the things, if government workers are getting paid more and getting these outrageous pension benefits that create these huge unfunded liabilities, they're aided and abetted by our elected officials. Because generally, elected officials, well, almost without exception, elected officials are not part of public employee unions. Those are the actual folks in the bureaucracy. The elected officials are not part of that system, but they're the ones who allegedly are the bargainers on behalf of the taxpayers in that little bargaining picture I painted at the beginning. So our elected officials are supposed to sit down across the table from their employees and bargain against them for wages and benefits on behalf of the taxpayers. Well, you know, they see taxpayers once or twice a week. Every day they mingle with their workers, so to speak. I mean, it's different for different government folks. But let's just say it doesn't take very long in office to feel a lot closer to the staff than you do to the taxpayers. And so it's not a very good negotiating scenario. One of the ways this manifests is that what I call fair weather Keynesianism is these state, and I'm going to show you some data just looking at state governments. But state governments, in principle, if they followed, and this is a grossly oversimplified sort of Keynesian, but the idea is they should be thinking, if they really believe in Keynesianism, they should be thinking, hey, the economy's booming, the private sector's doing great, jobs are growing, we should throttle back, lay low, just do the things that government has to do, and then when a recession hits, we jump out and we do a lot more stimulative stuff, and provide it directly or indirectly a lot more jobs. We deficit spend if need be, and help us get through the recession, and then so on. We cycle back and forth. That's essentially what Keynesian said. He talked very much about a throttling up and down of government spending in response to economic cycles. They only want the fun part. They only want to do the, hey, let's increase things when there's a recession, because you get a lot of political points for that. The throttling back during the boom, well, that's no fun. So they kind of neglect that part. So you get this disparity where, okay, the fun part is they hired a lot of people, especially at really high salaries, during the recession while the private sector was shedding jobs. But the rest of the story is, here we have this gray line at the bottom. This is how revenue and expenditures by states would have grown between 2002 and 2008 if they had grown revenue and expenditures at the rate of inflation combined with population growth. So it's a baseline. It's a generous rate of growth, as you can see, during that period of time that allows for the primary drivers of increases in government spending, the theoretical. People always say, well, we have to increase spending on X because the population has grown and there's been inflation. So you can't be spending the same as you were 10 years ago. This is what they spent during that time. So considerably more than the baseline. And this is their revenue. A whole heck of a lot more than the baseline. And you notice, between 2002 and 2007, we were going through one of their booms, and you don't see a dip in expenditures there, do you? So no, they were like, hey, it's a boom, let's spend even more. You know, if it's good during a recession, it must be even better during a boom, right? So we know we were talking about Keynes the other day, but now we're saying Keynes was wrong. It's always good to spend more. The burning question is, here, this is Fred. Where's Fred? Fred, you were complaining about government accounting last night. Okay, we hit this point, 2008, where suddenly revenue fell below expenditures thanks to the recession. Well, A, there's a problem that their expenditures didn't fall. The baseline dipped, the revenue dipped, but expenditures didn't. But all during this time, you notice this big space here? This is when revenue was exceeding expenditures. Where'd that money go? According to official government accounts, it just doesn't exist. There is no accounting for where that money went. I think in theory there might be a way to try to figure that out, but I have not wrapped my arms around any way from the publicly available data that state governments provide to figure that out. It's just not there. Now, you know they had to spend it on something. I mean, there's limited avenues. It didn't go to Switzerland. I mean, that would, you know, there's no way the legislators in 50 states could pull off a conspiracy like that. Heck, they can hardly walk across the street. So I don't know. It was spent by the government in some fashion that was simply not accounted for. And you can see it's a huge amount. Boy, if they'd saved 10% of that, that would have just about closed this gap. A little bit more rainy day savings would have taken care of the recession. But no, that's no fun. Okay, so labor unions versus taxpayers in a little bit more direct way. So aided and abetted by fair weather Keynesianism, there's no disincentive for the legislators, the elected officials, to rein in the unions that negotiate for these incredible and ridiculous expenditures, these incredible and ridiculous salaries and benefits. So I want to slice the economic effects of this in a couple of different ways. So here's one, just to give you a starter. Okay, so this is, CEI did this sort of thing where they stacked all these things up and they sort of ranked the states according to this, to evaluating these criteria. And what you get is, so you see the darker the color is, the more union friendly the state is. So this is a way of just ranking the states by how, according to state laws that favor collective bargaining and union power relative to less. And you can see, you know, there's a pretty unsurprising geographical distribution here. I was sort of stunned that California was only in the, not quite in the fully in the tank, but, and just to pay special attention here, let's see, Amaz, Tom, Beach, let's see, Julian. you've got, okay, Tennessee, these are the states that are the least friendly to big government labor, I should say, and these are the states that are most, the laws of which are most friendly to big government labor. And I say, boy, starting point for activists is, you know, what are these guys doing that these guys should be doing? You know, there's some pretty simple things, those 10 criteria. In each of those, there's pretty well understood differences between the bottom and the top states. So we know pretty clearly what legally needs to change. It's just getting the clout to do it. And I'll talk a little about that in a minute. Okay, we're about to come out with a report. I'm giving you a preview of some graphs from it. So this is where we looked at the ratio of public and private workers in all 50 states. And then we came up with a little bit of statistical analysis to see what kind of things are correlated with a relatively high versus relatively low ratio of government workers to private workers. So this doesn't drill down into why those public worker numbers are higher or lower, but look at this. So unfortunately, my color shading doesn't show as well. These are blue states. These are red states. What this data shows is the more Republican the voters are in a state, the more public workers you have relative to private workers. Very nice, counterintuitive, I think, little finding there. So somehow, the more conservative states have a higher ratio of government workers. And just to reinforce that, the more Republican the legislature is in a state, the higher the ratio of government workers to private workers. Yes, it defies conventional wisdom. What do you know? I think because the Republicans are very good at the rhetoric of small government and very poor at delivering small government. In some states, I mean, when we parse this by state, you'll see, you know, a few states don't quite fit this trend, but generally speaking, the statistical correlation is pretty strong. I'll also just point out that stimulus spending, more stimulus spending, more of the federal stimulus spent in that state equates with a higher ratio of public workers to private workers. And a longer run trend, so leaving aside the current stimulus spending, but looking at long run federal aid spending even more highly. So basically, the more a state sucks on the government teat, the more they're likely they have to have a relatively high proportion of government workers. So it's all very, you know, it's interesting that things, these last two results pretty much fit, I think, what anybody would guess in advance. But the failure of conservatives at the state level to actually deliver on fewer government workers is pretty striking. All right, let me just tell a little short story here about one particular union. This is California Correctional Peace Officers Association, aka California Prison Guards. Now, my next door neighbor for many years is a prison guard, and so all my golf buddies, other than Moz, are prison guards in a California prison. And they know what I do for a living, and I catch all kinds of hell over it, I can tell you. But we still get along. So, but it's interesting because I like to throw little nuggets at them when I come up with some new research. But this is the incarceration rate in California for over the last 20 years. You know, that's a pretty depressing figure we're familiar with in a lot of different dimensions. I just want to point out how sweet this is if you work in prisons. How much sweeter is it if you represent the guards that work in prisons? Because, needless to say, your membership has been skyrocketing. This is, in 20 years there, between 80 and 2000, California built 23 new prisons, and you could see increase the number of prison guards by orders of magnitude. This is prison spending in California as a percentage of the general fund is the numbers, and as a total amount, the line is the total amount, the numbers are the percentage. So the percentage, you know, is around 10% here, it's around 10% here, but the absolute number went up quite a bit. This looks strictly at the prison guards union. So this is... this is, the bars are membership, so their membership skyrocketed. The yellow line is the average salary. And I'm sorry, the bar is the revenue that the union collected from its members. The red line is the number of members, and the green line is the average pay. So not only were they growing the number of guards during this time, but look at the pay. Look, you know what you need to be a prison guard in California? You need to have graduated from high school or at least taken the GRE. Yeah, you have to take the test and you got to go through their little academy. So, I mean, basically you have to be physically fit and have got through high school. So it's about as unskilled a job as you could get. Now, you learn skills. Obviously, it's not an unskilled job, but the entrance requirements are pretty much as low as you can go. $73,000, really? And this is because California Prison Guards Union is extraordinarily politically powerful in California. As one Republican legislature told me, says there's only one union that gives Republicans money in California, and we're not going to piss them off. So the Republicans and the Democrats are totally in the tank with this union, and they wield enormous clout. One hand washes the other. It's amazing. Last year, there was a huge stink in California because they discovered, and Kennedy, you talked on the radio about this not long ago. 10,000 cell, they discovered that guards had systematically smuggled cell phones in and sold them at about $1,000 a pop to inmates. Let's see, 10,000 times 1,000, there's a little money there, isn't there? And so it was found out, and naughty, naughty, naughty guards. No one got fired. No one got penalized. Nothing except for now it's a little more pain in the butt for them to get into work because they get searched more often. That's how the system reacted is, well, we'll try to catch them more often. And while this controversy was brewing and radio talk show hosts were going on about it, editorials were saying, you've got to be kidding me, Brown said, well, you know what? Let's increase your benefits. So, you know, jacked up their vacation. 8 weeks. So these high school graduate, $75,000 a year guys also get 8 weeks vacation. 8 weeks vacation. You know, and it sort of perks right, cashing out sick time and so forth. So he increased their benefit package during a huge budget crisis, during a recession, while they were being exposed as obviously not public servants. So go figure. All right, some solutions, and I'm just going to shoot through these really quick. Okay, the worst idea to deal with the problems that we face, but the most commonly heard one is, well, we obviously just need more revenue from you people to take care of these public servants. Second worst, because it's essentially the same thing as a federal bailout, I can't believe how many people in state government I hear basically saying, you know, we're going to get away with this because ultimately the federal government will give us the money to cover what, you know, what we can't do ourselves. So the fact that our revenue has fallen below our spending is a real inconvenience, but ultimately if we borrow to cover it, we know the federal government will bail us out. This is California's strategy as they keep running up the debt. They believe their congressional members will deliver some federal money to solve the problem. I say, how about we actually take on union power, reduce it, and start moving more states from that bottom five to the top five in the actual legislative measures that govern collective bargaining. Reduce unfunded liabilities. We have to cut the benefits, and I'll show that in a little more detail. And you've got to cut spending. Look, if you've locked yourself in to some pay and benefits, or especially benefits for workers, it's very difficult to cut the benefits for people who have already worked for you and earned those benefits in a legal sense. You're going to have to pay for that, and so that means you can't pay for all the other things you want to pay for. So you're going to have to start making some cuts, which is no fun. Right-to-work states. Hey, there's an amazing correlation between right-to-work states and states' debts. On average, right-to-work states have much, much lower debt burdens than non-right-to-work states. I mean, it's pretty, look at that total. I mean, it's just amazing. So, right-to-work, being a right-to-work state, hey, Indiana just joined the crew 3 days ago, 4 days ago. That's just fabulous, but boy, you want to get this under control, there's a pretty obvious way to start. It's become a right-to-work state. Now, this is economic. So private industry growth, right-to-work states versus non-right-to-work states, job growth, yeah, this is awesome. Non-right-to-work states lost 1 million jobs, essentially. Right-to-work states gained more than 3 million. I don't know, to me, it seems like that one statistic alone in any logical world would drive the whole train. Where the number one concern of Americans right now is jobs, well, there you go, right to work. Utah is kind of the current model for pension reform, and this is some of the gory details, which I don't want to belabor, but they had an incredible fiscal crisis, they had an incredible pension overhang, and they just systematically, in a series of bills, tackled it. They shifted new employees to defined contribution instead of defined benefit plans. They ended double dipping, where employees would retire and draw full retirement while also then getting a new government job and collecting salary. You know, most places have something like, well, if you're working for a state salary, we hold on to your pension for that time. But a lot of places they've negotiated, no, we get both. So they put an end to that. They shifted for the defined contribution, the state basically puts in a percentage, workers put in a percentage. It's a little higher for public safety workers. So we know year on year how much we're going to put in. It's not this highly unpredictable defined benefit plan. And if they really, really want a defined benefit, that's fine, but the state's contribution is still capped. So it's really a good way of making sure they're not digging the hole any deeper and starting to tweak the stuff that they already owe to reduce those liabilities. Other states have done this. This is not impossible. You know, Michigan switched to a defined contribution for new employees, Alaska, Utah, other states. Now, this is kind of weak. I should say, as we heard from the governor last night, Puerto Rico shifted very recently to a defined contribution plan for new employees. Some other states have done this sort of mixed thing, which is kind of weak because the employees get an option and they've tried to constrain how much of a cost the employees choosing the defined benefit would be. but it's not nearly as vigorous a start as say Puerto Rico and Utah have done. So states are starting to make some changes, but you can see this is still only a handful of states. There's a long ways to go, and this is only the first step for all of these states. The fact that new employees are not going to be getting too outrageous of benefits only keeps the problem from getting bigger. It doesn't deal with the fact that you still have somewhere between 3 and 10 trillion in unfunded liabilities. Cutting government spending. This is Len and I have been working on this list. This is, you know, we roll this out every time we meet with any city, county, or state or federal official. It's like, you know, you got budget problems? Here you go. Here's your 10-point checklist for how to start getting a handle on things. And, you know, it essentially gets down to get more serious about budgeting and prioritizing your spending. Get serious about privatization. You own a lot of property that's costing you a lot of money. Stop it. if it's not delivering net benefits, get rid of it. Make privatization a systematic part of your business. Incorporate it into your planning. And you know, school choice and higher education spending. Because education, prison and education spending are two of the fastest growing categories. You've got to get those under control. So prison reform is in there, one of those bullets too. But there's a lot of tools, and all of these things have been done in multiple states, so it's not like you're reinventing the wheel. These are things that have been done. They work. We know they work. You just have to have the political will to do them. And as you can see, going all the way back through my presentation, you know, this is all about competition for political will. The unions are competing to provide such good benefits to the elected officials that they can stand up to the taxpayers, even though they're raping them. And you know, we the advocates on behalf of the taxpayers in small government are trying to give them the tools and the intellectual arguments and focus public's attention on the crisis to where public pressure, the only thing that can ever beat the unions is the public. You know, you cannot rely on political leaders to just say, I found the courage and I'm going to go down in the next election as long as I get some cuts in union benefits. That's not going to happen, except in rare occasions. And then it'll just get overturned as soon as they're thrown out of office. It's got to be people have to finally say, we can't abide this anymore, and we're not going to elect people that do this. I wanted to just list that we have a lot of stuff coming up in the next year that's related to this. We're studies on pensions, studies on the California prison guards, sort of taking that story I just told and laying it out in full flesh. Cutting spending. We're working with state and local budget reforms in several states. State and local privatization. It's a good year for that. We're working in all of these places, helping government officials implement. Lisa, who we'll see later, is working in several places in the country on school reform and school budget reforms, as well as school choice reforms. So, you know, this is a great opportunity for Reason to capitalize on people increasingly fed up, try to feed that, because that's the only way the revolution's going to happen. Thank you.